the other part of the solution will have to involve having this cultural transformation. And I'm sad to say that that is always the hardest part. And it's funny we talk about culture, because that is as true in Silicon Valley as it is in a very conservative country across the world that's trying to suppress women. It's just in a different dynamic, in a different way.
You're listening to The Other Half, Conversations with Men on Gender Equality with Chiara Condi.
So we're very lucky today. We have a new guest on our podcast, Mohamed El-Khairi, who lives in San Francisco. So welcome, Mo. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Chiara. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We're very interested in what you're going to say, because we've already had one tech entrepreneur tell us about his vision. So this is going to be really complimentary to know the vision of an investor. So to introduce Mohamed, Mohamed is the San Francisco-based managing partner of E11 Capital, a global venture capital firm based in the U.S. in the United Arab Emirates. In 2006, he moved to Dubai to build Zawiya.com, the Middle East-focused business intelligence and market data company, which was the Bloomberg of the Middle East, which was later acquired by Thomson Reuters. And he's been in San Francisco since 2011, supporting seed stage investment through Plug and Play, NXT Innovation, global innovation consulting firm based in San Francisco, Paris, and Milan, which helps Fortune 500 companies implement solutions as well as government and startups. And maybe a fact that is lesser known about him is also that he's a member of the Arab Film and Media Institute, a nonprofit based in San Francisco and Los Angeles, which has the largest Arab film festival outside the Middle East. So welcome, Mo.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you. No, it's an honor to be here.
And Mo, would you consider yourself a feminist or a promoter of gender equality? Is that something that's come to your mind?
Certainly, yes. In the sort of modern definitions of feminism, I consider myself a feminist. And it's really fascinating to see how also that term has evolved over time, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's about bringing equality, not just advancing women to advance women, but it's about bringing that gender balance in the world.
Right. Yeah. When I think about how I look at feminism and gender equity, it really stems from my roots. My father, who was born in Jerusalem, we were originally Palestinian, is probably one of the most progressive Arab men I know. And having brought in two girls and two boys and treated us exactly the same way, I really credit him for the sort of culture that I've been raised with to look at not just women, but really everyone, regardless of race, regardless of religion, regardless of sex or orientation, and really just treat everyone and everything equally with equity.
That's very beautiful. Can you tell us a little more about your father and how he treated your sisters?
Yeah, obviously, when you're born in and raised in an Arab Muslim household, there are very strong cultural inclinations and the sort of strive to put preferences on the male rather than the female. And we as a family fundamentally believe that our religion, if anything, at the time when it first came out, was a huge force to empower women. And when you sort of consider what type of rights women had pre-Islam versus post-Islam, it's amazing to see how empowered women were, even vis-a-vis their Western counterparts. It's just that you have over time this cultural ramification, just like you have here in the West, that tries to, you know, corner women or define women in a certain way. And my father has always resisted this. So in the way we were raised, for example, wherever my sisters wanted to achieve in life, they were never sort of boxed into having to be a certain way or having to get married, for example, or have kids. If they wanted to be career women, he completely empowered them to be that way. Similar to us, as with my brother and I. And so I think when you're raised this way, it only makes sense for you to want to continue on and even though sometimes it's hard given the way society is and culture is.
Yes, exactly. That's also another beautiful story that defies other forms of stereotype, other forms of cultural stereotype, which we have.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, I think we're all somehow in our family contrarians at heart. And nothing you want to see in the world that is right, that is equitable and just is easy, you know? And that's why you just have to keep on fighting whatever cultural norms exist that aren't actually suiting or being beneficial to the broader community or society. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. And if you don't actively do something to fight that, then history shows that, that things will never change by themselves.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Right.
Was there a specific episode in your life that you made you believe in this, or where you thought, whoa, I have to do something about this, something about gender inequality, or that caused you to become more aware about this?
Hmm. Well, I don't know if there was a specific moment that sort of woke me up. As I said, I always was aware of it, but there was definitely a moment in my life where it made me want to accelerate it and even focus more on it. And that was with the birth of my daughter. Just seeing her as a young kid, you know, absorbing all this information around her and seeing how she was deciphering it, just drove me to say, well, first I took an immediate interest in education.
Yeah.
But then it also made me realize, well, how is she interpreting these things that are being said to her, whether it's on television or through different shows or through just society in general, right? And I want to continue what my dad taught me, but also sort of modernize it and accelerate it in a way that's relevant to today's age, because the way things were when I was growing up are very different than they are today. And I feel that, especially living here in San Francisco, where it's a very progressive city, and we have a very progressive community, it makes things easier. But then that's not always obvious. For example, when she grows up and she's going to different parts of the world where it's not, these things aren't necessarily assumed. So I'm always trying to sort of bring about that type of awareness that, you know what, yes, we live in this society, but in other places, it's not as obvious. And we need to do whatever we can to uplift women everywhere. And it's going to start with her knowing who she is and what she wants to be, right? Having that type of confidence and knowing that she can be whatever she wants to be.
Exactly. I profoundly believe that all confidence is self-awareness, and that,
exactly,
that's what women unfortunately do not have enough of for various cultural and societal reasons. And that if we can give every woman that self-awareness, then she will claim her place in the world.
Yeah.
So I very much wish that for your daughter.
Thank you. It's honestly exciting. And I also have a son now. He's still very young, but my hope is also for me to raise him in a way where he's aware of this as well. And to your point about this podcast, it's important for men to be part of the conversation. You know, there's a saying we have in Arabic that a hand cannot clap on its own. You need two hands to clap. So that's why it's sort of that dichotomy that needs to be addressed in order to see through real impact and real change.
And how are you doing that as a father, as a husband? Do you feel very engaged in the life of your children? And how are you transmitting those values? Because often we have those values and we don't necessarily know how to get them through to the next generation.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Because I work on this global fund, and therefore most of my partners are abroad, and therefore I don't go into like an office. I don't check in. I don't check out. I have this flexibility. My wife, on the other hand, who is a career woman and has responsibilities at work, she manages a team, and she's doing very well at her career, thankfully. It sort of puts us in a position where I am picking up the kids, taking care of them from their school, also being involved in other parts of our kids' lives that, again, from a traditional standpoint, you would think the mom would take care of. And people have told me, oh, so you're a modern man, you know? And I say, why does the word modern have to exist? This just, he's a man, you know? And anyone who doesn't believe in this way of getting involved is maybe an old-fashioned man. That's how I would position it.
Exactly. Yeah. But in today's world, you're a hero for doing what most women do every day.
If only men knew how fun it is to actually do what, quote unquote, traditionally women do. I have such a joy being involved in, and that doesn't mean that my wife isn't. I mean, my wife is involved in a different way, right? And that's where we don't live this assumed life that because you're a woman, you do X, and because you're a man, you do Y. And it's just, you have to break down those assumptions and just be authentic about the situation. And right now, because I have this flexibility, at least from a time commitment standpoint, it only makes sense that I do these things. If it was a different situation, if my wife was flexible, she would be doing it. It's just, we don't have these assumptions.
You're very much a team.
Exactly. Yeah.
Having those activities that you do with your children, taking care of them, it's also allowed you to build another relationship with your children, right? Because it's much more special in the fact that you're active and that you spend so much time with them.
Yeah, it's true. We're lucky to be living in such a progressive city because when I look for example, books to read with my daughter specifically, I'm always looking for ones that are trying to put this equity lens not across only gender, but across, you know, race and ethnicity and culture and religion. So, for example, there's actually a children's book that talks about Malala Yousafzai's experience in Afghanistan. And, you know, it's one of her favorite books because she sees that what a young girl who believes in her education can achieve. And, you know, there's obviously sort of the bad guys in the story, you know, and seeing how she interacts, how she assesses, you know, these bad people, quote unquote. I say, look, it's just that they don't know. They're not educated in a way to understand that a woman or a girl can do whatever she wants. And it's a children's book, you know, it's like being done in a very sort of gentle manner. But I feel this is where maybe because of my passion in the area and, you know, having also been raised in abroad and understanding these dynamics a little bit differently, I can add my take to it. My wife, she's born and raised here in California. And as aware and as woke she is to the situations around the world, I feel like as a dad, I can also bring that element to my kids' education and experiences.
That's very important. I think that the content that we feed our children also is going to create their future. So, and I think this is especially important with young women today. Right. So I think it's important to make those choices as a parent, and those choices matter. And that's why it's also important to be involved in your children's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
And speaking of female role models, was your mother an inspiration to you also in how you were parenting, or your father? And what values did they transmit?
So my mom is actually an artist, and she, through her art, has expressed a wide variety of themes, of important messages. As I had mentioned, we were originally from Palestine, and there's a very strong reputation for the Palestinian woman as being extremely resilient, you know, given, you know, the history of our people. And a lot of her artwork has exemplified that as her being not just a central person of a family, but also sort of the woman represents our roots in our land. And, you know, Palestinian women are very strong-willed, very strong-minded. And, you know, my mom's art, has really encompassed this type of belief that, you know what, it's ironic that at least from a kind of global media standpoint, right, that Arab women, Muslim women are seen as always repressed. But if only we could use art and other tools out there to show that, no, there are actually exact opposite scenarios, right?
Yes.
Then this is where I get that sort of will to persevere and say, you know what? No, we have to show the other side and educate and bring awareness to these issues. So that's the role that my mom has played in my life, is to, you know, despite difficult circumstances or what is assumed, you have to always keep pushing boundaries and try to do whatever you can to do what's right.
And it's very beautiful how she reconciled those identities and made it part of her art.
I'm super blessed and extremely humbled by having my mom and my dad in my life and for everything that they taught me. So I can only hope to bring that to my kids as well.
Yeah, and it seems like your father was also a very big believer in his children and very encouraging as a figure.
Yeah, he was. I remember like when I was growing up, every night he would, over the dinner table, share with us a story about his youth or, you know, his days in Palestine and, you know, even how his relationship with his mother was, you know. It's a funny joke, but I tell you, Palestinian women are known to be strong. Well, my mm-hmm. grandmother's nickname was the General. That's how strong she was. It was funny how, like, even generationally, right? It's not just, oh, Palestinian women are strong today. They've always been strong, you know? And so, you know, I think that's something that through storytelling and just being able to share our, you know, lives and our experiences, we can make a big difference. This is exactly why I joined the board of the Arab Film and Media Institute.
You know, that was going to be my next question. Exactly.
There we go.
Is that what drove you? I saw it coming. Yeah, that's very beautiful. I actually went on their website and I was very positively surprised not only to learn about what a huge film festival you guys organize, part of it, but also what amount of work the organization does to mm-hmm. undo, and sort of staying in the theme of the podcast as well, to mm-hmm. undo negative images and stereotypes about Muslims in the media in the United States.
Yes.
By encouraging young voices and putting out their positive role models and doing this through film and education. Because right. young people from Arab, Muslim, and Middle Eastern communities are particularly vulnerable to the effects of racial and religious prejudice and the scarcity of positive images mm-hmm. of their heritage in the media. And that's, you know, in a way, it kind of resonated with me because it's also true about women in another mm-hmm. way.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very powerful. But tell me more about your engagement there and how it started and where it came from.
Yeah, with pleasure. And just to say, I mean, I'm extremely proud of the organization. I mean, just yesterday were the 92nd Academy Awards, and four of our films actually were nominated.
Wow.
Two of which were actually focused on a woman as the main character. One was a documentary, and the other one was a sort of a feature. Well, actually, both were documentaries, and they were both nominated in the same sort of category of documentary category. They didn't win, but we're still very proud of them. And
can you tell us the title of them, so the title of the movie, so people can go watch them?
Yes, and be inspired? Yes. So the first one is called For Sama, Sama.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is called The Cave.
Great.
Yeah, check it out. So my involvement with the Film Institute was, well, let me backtrack. So when I first met the organization, they were really just a one event organization, which is the Arab Film Festival, which, as you said, produces the largest Arab film festival outside of the Middle East, or the Arab world, I should say. And one of the first things, you know, we did as a new board, because I joined with a few other new members, was that we wanted to really drive a kind of year-long programming as opposed to just being a one-time, you know, one event-based organization.
Yeah.
And there's just so much to do in terms of whether it is showing the films more regularly or even showing short films more regularly throughout the year at a variety of school districts here in the Bay Area to start, but hopefully across California, so that we can change the perception of Arabs and Muslims among the youngest of generations. And by change, I mean evolve, right? We're not trying to, it's really just offering different perspectives, because the Arab world, as I'm sure you know, is just so diverse. You have people from the LGBT community who live in that part of the world who, you know, their stories need to be told. we have obviously women and young girls who are aspiring to change things for the betterment of their entire, not just gender, but broader society, right? I mean, and their stories need to be told. And a bunch of other minorities as well, who we've tried to use this platform to give them a voice. And so when we talk about showcasing this across, let's say, the school system, or for that matter, even it helping up and coming artists and creative folks from that part of the world, I would love to see women focused initiatives so that we can give them the platform to be connected to mentors, trainers, and different types of initiatives, so that we really are able to provide a level playing field. You know, I'm actually taking a page out of my tech investing background, because people don't actually know this, but when you look at it from a percentage standpoint, there are more women entrepreneurs in tech in the Arab world, percentage wise, when compared to their US counterparts, which is crazy to think, but, you know, statistically that is true. And so, you know, and I feel like that's how much opportunity there is, right, in that part of the world. If you provide that level playing field, it's amazing to see the amount of creativity that can be unlocked by women and girls in that part of the world, among others, other areas, like I said, whether it's people from the LGBT community or other communities that need to be empowered.
Yes. And, you know, stereotypes are nothing more than ingrained images that are repeated. So there's nothing better than positive role models to undo those ingrained images and to show a new narrative and a new story.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for women, and that's true also for many other minorities. And
Right.
So I'm excited to see how that evolves. And really excited to watch those movies. And now that we're talking about this subject, we're going to come back to the women entrepreneurs later, mm-hmm. because I'm very interested in that. But now that we're talking about this subject, I wanted to ask more of a personal question, because you've experienced diversity in your own life. And gender, as we said, gender diversity is not the only form of diversity. It's one form of diversity that one can experience. But you've grown up as a child of Palestinian immigrants in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And how has this identity shaped you? And how has it contributed to who you are? And now you're living in San Francisco as well, and you've lived all over the world.
Yeah, I feel like my background is a bit of a salad, you know. You know, I was born in Geneva, and the first 8 years of my life were in Saudi Arabia. And then we immigrated to Montreal. Palestinian origins, but obviously because of the situation, we didn't have a passport. I was born with a Jordanian passport.
Wow.
Then we immigrated to Montreal when I was 8 years old. And Montreal is an extremely diverse city. And unlike the United States, it's not exactly a melting pot. It's really, and the Canadian government actually likes to pride itself on this, in that, you know, when you immigrate to Canada, you are where you are from. You just happen to also be Canadian, you know, whereas in America, you're American first, right? And then you are where you're from. So as a result, you know, I grew up with, you know, Greeks and Italians and other Arabs, with Latinos and, you know, people from Haiti, and they were all, you know, very much from those countries. And when I decided to make the move to Dubai years later, as I was kind of midway in my career as an investment research person, I had the opportunity to go to Dubai. And again, you know, Dubai is really, if you want to see a diverse place, like a freshly diverse place, you know, you go to Dubai, because, you know, when you meet someone from South Africa or someone from India, it's like they've just arrived, just like you, to Dubai. It's such a young city,
yeah.
You know, and that too. And so all these experiences have really enabled me to have what I call perspective discovery. It's like when you sit down with people from all over the world, you really get to understand how they look at certain things, whether it's a problem or an opportunity. And seeing the similarities in how at least from my vantage point, maybe this is just because I like to associate myself with people who are progressive, you know, in nature, is seeing how this move towards gender equity exists across all these different cultures.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing. It actually becomes the fabric that unites us all.
Exactly. Do you think that this background has made you more sensitive and aware about diversity issues?
Yeah, I mean, the issues are global, obviously, and they have different, you know, levels of severity. You know, obviously, you know, when you talk about gender equity in places like, you know, let's say Afghanistan, it's going to be very different than when you talk about it in the United States. What kind of connects us is the problem. It's just the solution needs to be multifaceted.
And what about you in Silicon Valley today? Do you feel as if you belong?
It was interesting moving out here. It really was. I, at least at the beginning, I didn't feel like I really related, despite, you know, having helped build Zawia, and we successfully eventually exited it to Thomson Reuters. You know, it's almost like that exit didn't count by Silicon Valley standards, you know? It's true.
About that, we want to know.
Well,
the story.
I mean, look, again, this is the contrarian in me talking, but it's like, oh, that's, you've got the major exits that you hear about in the industry here in Silicon Valley. And so our exit, which took place in Dubai, was cute by their standards, you know. And it's funny because as I was talking about my experiences of building a business abroad, and I mean, I was very proud of the fact that our office in Beirut, 80% were women.
Wow.
We had an incredible team of women in Lebanon who
was it intentional or
we were looking at candidates to hire out of universities because we had our research team there. We had our various types of teams there. And as we interviewed, we just realized that, you know, the ones who were really doing well and had the best chances of succeeding and understood our business the best were women. I mean, eventually that creates its own type of snowball effect, you know, because then as you hire, you know, more and more women, it just kind of grows, you know, organically. But it wasn't like this thing that, oh, this isn't going to be a women only office, you know. That wasn't the intention. But yeah, so now kind of talking about life here, you know, you see the good things about Silicon Valley, the amazing things about Silicon Valley, but you also, you know, quickly understand the not so good things and how insulary Silicon Valley culture can be. You have to have a sort of a typical profile to make it. You should have either, you know, worked at Google or Facebook or one of these big companies, or you should have like some sort of Harvard or Stanford type of background in your education, or you should have worked at another kind of big company, like another big branded company. Like, I felt that Silicon Valley just is obsessed with that, you know, and the money was being directed to those types of entrepreneurs. And the typical profile was the white male. You know, primarily, you know, by far, statistically, they were receiving the most amount of venture funding. And you can get all philosophical about how that is a representation of a broader systemic issue that exists in America. But as progressive and as globally minded Silicon Valley is, it was amazing to me how, from a venture funding standpoint, from a hiring standpoint, I mean, 8 years ago when I moved here, it was just clear to me, like, wow, this is crazy. And it was ironic that I had to come from abroad to realize this here. But, you know, as we all know, things are changing.
Yeah. And it's interesting because even you as a male, as a Canadian as well, because you did grow up in Canada as well and spend a lot of time there. So, I mean, Canada is not, you know, the other part of the world. It's quite similar, I'd say, to the US culturally.
Yeah.
And as somebody who has built, you know, has gone to Dubai and built this ultra successful startup, then sold to Thomson Reuters, coming out with a success and still being discriminated against and still feeling that not belonging, that's saying something very powerful there.
I don't want to say discriminated because that's a big term and I wasn't discriminated against. There are other people who are being discriminated against and they are rightfully using that term, discriminated. I just felt this almost lack of relatability, at least initially, right? Yeah. It takes time to find your community. It takes time to find your village. And it's funny because I used to live in Silicon Valley. Now I live deep in San Francisco and at the end, you just associate yourself with people who share your values, you know? And as much as I work in venture capital right now, I'm practicing the utilization of venture capital differently. And, you know, it just happens to be that a lot of the companies that I've supported are run by women. Again, that was never an intention. I just look at the facts and see, is this company, you know, a viable business? Is it solving a real problem? Is the execution right? Is the traction right? And more often than not, I find that women run businesses tick all those boxes. Whereas with a lot of other companies run by guys, tech bros, they're just, you know, riding a wave, right? And it's like driving this momentum around, well, I already have this investor or that investor in. It's kind of like more hype driven, you know? And I would say that my advice for not just women entrepreneurs, but all entrepreneurs is to always try not to be that hype driven company because it's going to fundamentally not drive your success long term.
Yes, to focus on the substance and your product and what you're building.
Yeah.
The other half will return after a quick break.
You work in venture capital today and as a partner of a VC fund that you created between here and United Arab Emirates. And tech today has not received the best publicity in terms of gender equality. You know, in June and July 2017, the New York Times reported extensively on the backlash against sexual harassment in Silicon Valley, pointing out to prepositioning and inappropriate messages and sexism among venture capital investors and investing in female-led startups is very low. According to TechCrunch, it hit $3.3 billion in 2019, which is only 2.8% of venture capital invested across the entire United States. And only 9% of the venture capitalists investing in tech startups are women. So it seems like Silicon Valley is a very difficult place for women, and there are a lot of inequalities. Perhaps it's the growth trumps all mindset, or there's something that makes it that so that it's still very an unequal place. And why do you think that is, in your experience? Why is it more difficult to be a female founder in Silicon Valley?
All your statistics are very unfortunately and sadly accurate. The way I see it is that gender inequity in Silicon Valley is part of a broader problem within Silicon Valley. And right now, the industry, in my humble opinion, has reached a point where it's all about building large portfolios and not necessarily fundamentally focusing on building businesses. So that's at a high level. So VCs are just building these bigger, bigger portfolios and giving more and more and more companies, money to companies, hoping that one or two are going to make up for the rest that, that go sideways or fail, you know?
Yeah.
And so as a result, this is why you, you know, you have the situation of more and more companies failing at the growth stage rather than failing at the pre-growth stage. Now, when you look at the culture of that investing, men are driving a lot of the investment because it fits within this broader culture of spray and pray investing. When women are presenting themselves to investors, part of the issue with investors is they're already looking at things from a algorithmic or statistical standpoint. When there's not enough data, according to these VCs, to prove that women actually run businesses more successfully, because historically men have been getting all the money, then it just continues the sort of comfort zone way of investing and thinking. So it's almost that these VCs don't want to get out of what's already working for them.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the problem, is that they're comfortable with what's already in place. They're making a lot of money with what's already going on. So why ruin a good thing? That's the mentality that, you know, when you couple it with sort of the broader issues of the way Silicon Valley operates today within the VC world, you start realizing, no wonder women aren't getting their fair share. So in order to address all these statistics that you've mentioned, yes, we need women-only focused funds. We need to. That's part of the solution. But the other part of the solution will have to involve having this cultural transformation. And I'm sad to say that that is always the hardest part. And it's funny we talk about culture, because that is as true in Silicon Valley as it is in a very conservative country across the world that's trying to suppress women. It's just in a different dynamic, in a different way.
Yes. And I've always believed in this approach in dealing with diversity in companies, that, you know, it's not about fixing women. It's about creating an environment that works for women and changing the culture so that women can thrive in that culture. So we can all thrive in our culture, no matter who we are or where we come from.
It's a win-win. And the thing is that it's like anytime you want to try and change culture, you have to look at this generationally. You know, when my dad was trying to explain to us as his kids the importance of being fair, regardless of gender, the way he went about it was very different than the way we're going to go about it today. And that's going to be very different also the way the next generation is going to go about it. And it's just this constant picking at the problem and unraveling it and unpacking it in a way where it only would make sense that they realize that, you know what, I'm just, you know, holding on to this way of thinking that is ultimately detrimental to myself. And I think it's starting. You're starting to see now more and more of these initiatives take place within Silicon Valley, at least in the last 8 years. I can't even imagine what it was like 20 years ago or 15 years ago for that matter. But there's a long, long way to go, Chiara. And we just have to keep pushing. So yeah, it's exciting.
What I always say is that we can each do what we can do in our little corner of the world. And if each person takes care of their little corner, we're going to get a lot of the earth covered.
Yeah, exactly. Persistence is key.
Building on that, can you tell us more about E11 Capital and how you are addressing this as an investor?
Yeah, so we built E11 as at least with our first fund, as a slightly different vehicle than what you'd expect from a VC firm. So we call ourselves a hybrid fund in the sense that we operate a fund of funds business at the seed stage. So we invest in other funds, and we operate a syndicate business for more mature companies. Fund two, which my partners are currently building, will be a direct investment vehicle focused at the growth stage. With our fund of funds business, what's cool here is supporting our funds and selecting companies to invest in at the seed stage. You know, I'm always looking at it from a overall thesis alignment standpoint, but curious to always see how many women-led businesses are being showcased to us. I'm pleased to say that a lot of the companies that are run by women within our fund of funds portfolio are run by women, which is really great. But I think we have to see more. And what's interesting is how a lot of the solutions that we've deployed in, whether they are in healthcare or education, that are run by women come from solving the problem from a uniquely woman's perspective in those sectors, you know, especially I think healthcare. So when you talk about things like pregnancy or what it looks like from a future of work standpoint, like how do women work with the realities of pregnancy and getting back to work, you know, so solving problems around those areas, I feel like tech and Silicon Valley has wildly ignored these areas. I mean, these are real problems. And so forget that there's a market opportunity there. That's always on the business side. But really, from a problem-solving standpoint, it's amazing to see how, you know, these women experience these problems themselves and they want to see tech solving them. That's what really gets me motivated.
And to have diverse answers, you need diverse perspectives. So that's why it's also really important to have women at the table for anything. Were your partners already convinced about this, the importance of diversity in women, or did you have to convince them, or were they already convinced by the subject?
Well, yeah, they're obviously convinced. Otherwise, we wouldn't be executing what we're doing. But obviously, being here and them being there, it kind of goes back to that concept of being able to do what you can given the, you know, realities of your of one's situation, right? So it's kind of a tough question to answer because I mean, I don't want to speak on their behalf or anything like that, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's really interesting if we go back to the bias that we see against women entrepreneurs, because it really happens in the beginning, because women are being capped out. And once they get the funding for their startups perform just as well. And in future startup fundraising rounds, they get just as much fundraising as men. So it is all today about the stereotypes, about the lack of credibility and everything that keeps women out the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was very interesting what the research showed about that.
Yeah. I mean, that just proves that the level playing field doesn't exist, right? And this is what I've always say, at least from our fund standpoint, is let's just provide that level playing field and then let the data speak for itself. I mean, over the last 8 years, advised, invested, supported about 100 companies. And I can confidently say that the vast majority of them that are doing well are run by women. And I actually reflected that information with my stakeholders, with my partners. And I think that that's something that just by providing a level playing field, you can see tremendous results. So we need more and more funds to take that approach that don't have that sort of confirmation bias and really can drive the industry forward for everybody.
And what do you think have been the reasons that there have been so many women entrepreneurs in the Middle East that has created such an environment that has allowed them to thrive?
I just think women in the Arab world have just so much to give. And when it came to building entrepreneurial ecosystems out there, it was just amazing to see how so many stepped forward because they have so much to give. It's like they needed that outlet, and entrepreneurship and entrepreneurialism became that outlet for so many women. And it's amazing to see. And I'm very proud of the success and of the momentum that they have created for other women and young girls in our region. And it becomes that much more powerful when you juxtapose that with the assumptions that are made about the region. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It really shows you that there are a lot of stereotypes about what we imagine women are facing.
Yeah, I would even say that that's also part of the motivation, right, for them. And this is why you see such a plethora of companies that are run by women, started by women, because it's like, you know what, you know, we're not going to take it and say, and I don't want to speak on their behalf, but this is why I feel at least there's a strong community of women run entrepreneurs. And now we're starting to see women run VCs. It's the same thing when it comes to diversity and inclusion in the workplace, to have more women or more people of color inside the team. But it's great. But we also need to have people in positions of decision making, right? Mm. It's not only about filling a statistic, right? It's also saying, okay, well, also the decision makers happen to be diverse or in this case, women. You know, and that's something that I think should be as much emphasized, if not more, if you really, truly want to leapfrog the industry.
Yes, it was interesting when I was reading the studies. And by the way, somebody named Ian Hathaway did some really great research on diversity, venture capital and startups in the United States.
Okay.
And I was reading what he was writing, and I read that New York, for example, is doing a lot better than Silicon Valley in terms of diversity and funding of women-led startups.
I believe it.
And that was also because there was a much larger diversity among the VC pool. And there were a lot more women in the VC pool than in Silicon Valley. And that was probably also trickling down to the startups.
Yeah. Not to knock off Silicon Valley all the time, but one thing that I'll say is, you know, what's working against Silicon Valley is the legacy. Is this a legacy issue, right? That, okay, this is where you have the widest concentration of venture capitalists. This is where you have by far the widest concentration of tech companies. And it's been this way for decades. So as a result, when you're trying to evolve the center of it all, you know, the mecca of it all, it becomes that much harder because of the legacies, the deep cultural understandings of these things, which is why, like, when I go to LA a lot, I see, you know, to your point about New York, a lot more women run companies, a lot more women run VCs out there. Same thing in Seattle, same thing in Colorado, Austin. The numbers are so tiny when you compare it to the giant that is Silicon Valley, that the opportunity to do more progress there is that much greater, you know?
But that's really interesting. Maybe new tech ecosystems are evolving around new values.
Exactly. That's the opportunity, right? Is to say, okay, well, let's build this momentum around the world, or around the United States. And it's just a matter of time before Silicon Valley starts to change. And I can even tell you, just from when I talk to some of these VC funds, I won't mention any names, obviously, but when they tell me about different partners that they want to hire, who I can help them, I say, okay, well, what kind of partner are you looking for? A lot of them will tell me off the record, they'll tell me, look, ideally, we would like to have a woman on board. So it's starting to change, you know?
Yes, exactly. And as we know, things that have been in place for longer also take longer to change. So maybe it's an evolution that will happen, that is happening gradually. And soon we're going to see the effect of that evolution that started.
Yeah, agreed.
And I'm really interested, because we've been talking about these issues, but I know that you're also very, very interested in making an impact. And impact has a big part of your work.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a bit more about that, and where, you know, where that desire came from as an investor, and what kind of impact you want to make?
Yeah. I mean, it's early days in my initiative, but one of the things that I've come to realize is that the business models of the future will have a purpose-driven component to them. They must, in order for them to survive over the long term. You know, gone are the days where it's all about, or only about, profit maximization or shareholder return optimization or maximization. In order to fundamentally do well, you need to do good. And so when I think about the types of businesses that I want to support in the future, it's not just solving a problem, but it's also companies that are intrinsically bringing about change, social impact, and sustainability to the industries that they serve. And one of the things that I want to have as a sort of common denominator, you could look at equity kind of in a verticalized manner, but what I find is more of a horizontal solution is ensuring that across everything I do, we're ensuring gender equity, you know? So when you talk about, you know, digital infrastructure, when you talk about financial literacy, when you talk about education, are we ensuring that women and girls are having as much access as men and boys to these solutions, you know? And so I do believe that impact or sustainability and impact and innovation are all going to be one and the same in the future. And so this is why I'd love to I mean, it's early days, as I said, but, you know, exploring the idea of building something that could speak to those values.
Wow, that's really amazing and much needed. And do you believe that as venture capitalists, all venture capitalists have a responsibility in the future of the world by investing in tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this again, not to be controversial, but I feel that the way people view venture capitalists is very much opportunists, right? That they're in it to make the big money. They have the money. They want to make more money. You know, you have investors who think this way, but the actual practice of venture capitalism can be applied in such a way where you can intrinsically do well, but also do good. And so when you think about the dynamics of the industry, the investors who are providing the venture capitalists with the funds to invest, so the limited partners, whether they are family offices or corporations or government agencies or institutionals, they are starting to think more and more along those, you know, sustainability and impact driven mindsets. And so when you think about the role of the VC going forward, and on top of that, they're becoming more sophisticated in dealing with, you know, direct investments. Mm-hmm. So you start thinking about what is the role of the VC going forward? Is this actually a sustainable industry the way it is set up today? And my answer is no, it is not. You know, family offices now are coming in directly into these deals. You know, they don't need a VC. You have corporations setting up their corporate venture capital units. They don't need the VCs, right? And so I think over the next 20 years, you're going to start seeing this evolution of how venture capital is practiced. And if it's not aligned with the values of their LPs, then they're just going to disappear. So fundamentally, I find that if you want to call yourself a venture capitalist in the future, you're going to have to be more aligned with the times of change. And that's the thing that goes back to what I was saying earlier about the issues around gender equity within the tech and VC world. People are comfortable with the status quo, you know, because it's working for some people and it's very powerful people.
And it's worked in the past. So there's a reassurance in the past as well.
Yeah, there's no incentive to change. And the thing is also, let's be honest. You have to also, when you hear of initiatives, like how much of that is embedded within your values or is it more of an afterthought? You know, You've done all the damage and now you're dedicating, you know, 5 or 10% of what you're doing to, you know, gender equity. No, you're either all in or you're not.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I worry about is, you know, they have these big brands, they have these big, you know, platforms, you know, you hear about big firms making big announcements, but I wonder how much of it is actually for real, or is it PR, or is it just an afterthought? I think that in the future, impact sustainability, which gender equity is a huge component of, you know, you're going to have that as part of your entire value system.
Yes, exactly. It's a core value of your company or business. It's not an initiative and a one-off initiative or a standalone initiative.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's something really important for any business or any company, and no matter what size, to think about.
Yeah.
But I really like what you said about venture capital is also evolving and needs to adapt to tomorrow's world. So in order to survive, it will have to go through those value changes.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because VCs invest in all these disruptive companies. And it's like a lot of VCs have clearly made a ton of money on these disruptive technologies. But then when you talk about VCs disrupting themselves, it's a different conversation. And it's going to take time. But I think that there's a nice vocal but small movement that's taking place, and that will hopefully make it the norm sooner rather than later.
Exactly. And the more voices are heard, the more it will become the norm. So
yeah,
I'm confident that it will change in the upcoming years.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's already happening, as we said, outside of Silicon Valley. You know, you're starting to see more and more gender equity or parity across tech ecosystems and investor ecosystems as compared to here. So it would be even amazing to see other ecosystems lead the charge, right? For once.
Yes. That's leaving us with a very positive note. And I really want to ask you one last question. This podcast is about getting people to become change makers of gender equality in their own lives, because we often get really overwhelmed by the state of the world.
Yeah.
And in many ways, in more than one, anywhere in the world. And we often think that we are powerless in front of what's in front of us, and that our challenges are so big that we don't know where to start. So this is starting to say, each one of us counts. Each one of us is somebody who has colleagues, family members, employees, activities. And with all of that, we all make choices in our life that affect the change that we want to make. And in this case, gender equality. And so, you know, what do you think men can do to think more about the subject and support the issue in their own lives? And how can we each be the change that we want to see?
Well, I think it will start with stepping out of your own comfort zone and what is presumed, you know, the way you approach stepping out of your comfort zone is the first thing that a man should do in order to see through change. Because part of the foundations of any disruptive hypothesis, Kiara, is taking what is assumed and then reverse engineering it. And that's amazing when you look at how tech has managed to change our lives. I mean, when you look at how Google was built, or how Zipcar was built, or the way PayPal was built, they've taken every part of the value chain of their industries, looked at what is currently being practiced, and then flipped it on its head. So for example, with Google, instead of, you know, you going on a television set and being shown ads passively, no, it's actually going to show you ads based on an active search that you did, right? And, you know, mirroring those search based on what you are actively seeking. It's a very different way of thinking about advertisement, of how to build an advertising business. And that is true for many, many other online and tech businesses out there. So if you were to take parts of that mentality and apply it to the change that you want to see in the world, that you see as too hard, too difficult. I tell this a lot to myself, and it's not always easy. You know, it's always easy to just do what you think is right. But a lot of the times what is right is the exact opposite. If you were just to give yourself the space, give yourself the opportunity to understand that other perspective. We're talking about gender equity. So if you are, you're, let's say, have stakeholders who are, you know, investors, and all are looking for is financial returns, right? You know, you're just investing based on what you already know has worked, which in this case is mostly investing in male-led businesses. The opportunity here to unlock value for your own investors is to give women the level playing field that they deserve in order to create this win-win outcome. Just give yourself that other perspective. And I relate that back to a philosophy that I've carried throughout my life, is it's all about perspective discovery, right? The more perspectives you allow yourself to learn, the better you will have a chance to see through the changes you want to see in the world. It's hard.
Of course, change is hard.
I can't tell you how amazing it is to see how change can be achieved once you step out of your comfort zone. And I think it's a continuous process. It's definitely a continuous process for me personally. But I fundamentally believe that in order to see through the change that you want to see, as hard as that may be, you have to, you know, open yourself to different perspectives and actually see how much value can be unlocked by opening yourself to different perspectives.
As you said, change is difficult.
Right.
And we all have to, in a way, force ourselves through it because it's not easy and it's not what comes natural.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't come natural. And that's the thing, right? Like you know, we have been conditioned to think this way and people think it's natural, but it's not. You've been conditioned to think this way. And so I almost want to say you almost have to unbrainwash yourself to think in a more open and in a more egalitarian manner. And that's hard, you know, especially when you talk about culture or things like culture, when you talk about even things like market momentum, you know, these are cultures. There are strong forces that drive you to just keep doing what you think is right or what is already working for you without necessarily having to broadening your impact and broadening, you know, the kind of change that you want to see. You're just, it's amazing. It's amazing how hard that is. Like I said earlier, it's a small movement. It's a growing movement. It's a strong movement that I feel it's inevitable, you know, because like anything that we've accomplished as a civilization, right, as a human civilization, it's not until we started realizing that, yeah, like, why have we been doing it this way en masse, you know? Then you started saying, oh, that's when you start seeing the change being, you know, more widely accepted.
Yeah. So that leaves us with a very positive note about history and how it goes forward and how little by little there's hope for our continued evolution on this subject, like on many others.
Definitely. I'm an optimist. So, you know, always excited about these changes. And so people like you and you know, the initiatives that you've undertaken to bring about awareness on gender equity, to me, are just as important as the women entrepreneurs, the women investors, the women leaders that are out there. And, you know, I'm here to support your initiative in any way I can.
Oh, thank you, Mo. Thank you, Mo. I really, really appreciate that. And as I always say, you know, what humans do, they can also undo. And so everything, our culture, everything that we've created, you know, we've created and we've fabricated through centuries of humanity. And we can also, you know, today work together to think another way. So thank you for helping us think another way today. And thank you for helping in your corner of Silicon Valley to help people think a different way about this subject. It's very important.
Thank you, Kiara. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
And that's all for this episode. Please subscribe, leave us a review, or get in touch on email, kiara@kiarakondi.com. This episode of The Other Half was edited by me, Lishan Huang. Until next time.